As long as there has been live theater, artists have grappled with the public issues of their day. From the ancient Greeks to today, theater has had the power to provoke, inspire, and challenge authorities and orthodoxies. This week, a playwright and an actor help us explore the power of theater. They are Kevin Doyle and Sauda Jackson, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Every week we try to make sense of the stories that shape public understanding by spending time with storytellers and analysts. This week we're joined by two talented storytellers. Kevin Doyle is an award-winning playwright as well as the artistic director of Sponsored by Nobody Theater in New York. Alongside him is Sauda Jackson, an actor working at the forefront of New York's Experimental Theater Company. Kevin and Sauda, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about the Sponsored by Nobody.
The name or the company?
Both.
My father came home from a Neil Young concert when I was growing up, and he came home with this beer cozy that had Sponsored by Nobody on it. And when I was in college, to give a name, that's what I thought of, and now we're stuck with it since the New York Times gave us a good review.
You've got to take a good review, right?
Yes.
Always.
Yes. But as I look back, I think the name is really appropriate for what it's like when you graduate theater school or art school in New York, where you kind of are just kind of left to the lions in a way, and you have no resources, and you have to scrape an existence together. And that's kind of...
There's a defiant quality about it.
Yeah.
Right? You're sponsored. Yeah. You haven't sold out. You're sponsored by
nobody. No, we haven't sold out. We've been supported by some pretty nice European institutions, but we haven't sold out.
Yeah. So we want to talk to you about the arts funding. We'll do that a little bit later.
Sure.
What kind of productions does the company do, and sort of that sort of ties us into what we're doing here today?
Well, I think what we've kind of developed over the years is a method by we investigate these kind of large-scale social issues or public policy issues, and we kind of research them and distill them into engaging material, but not in a normal traditional theater way. It's more of a multidisciplinary or some would say interdisciplinary method or means, where we're not kind of following a linear narrative track in some of the work. We're kind of coming at it through abstraction, repetition, other types of usages, live cameras on stage, choreography, mixed media, sometimes bordering on installation. And we use these different tools or methods to investigate an issue like, say, the Iraq War or the financial crisis or arts funding in America.
So you started in New York City.
Yes.
And you're based there, but now you perform in many parts of the world. And talk about the growth. This is been a good thing. How did it happen?
I always knew that some of our work was more of a European style, a contemporary experimental style. And I grew up in New York, and I saw European companies coming through places like the Brooklyn Academy of Music or PS122 or other venues. And I knew I always wanted our work to get there. And when I thought we had a caliber of work at that level, I started to approach people. And they said yes to the WMD project, and we've been invited back now three or four times now.
So why do social injustice issues? Why not do Shakespeare? Why not do Tennessee Williams?
Everybody does Tennessee Williams. Everybody does Shakespeare. And we really need this particular theater during this climate right now.
Well, talk about that.
I'm just a little girl from Chicago who had a mother who was in the movement, and so I was raised on that. So when I got called in to audition for Sponsored by Nobody, for I was in Behind the Bullseye first, it spoke to me as just a person who wanted to make a theater that wasn't the average theater. This is avant-garde on 20 to me. And he's right, we do compositions, it's more like tableaus, it's not linear, it's not traditional. Sometimes you dance, sometimes you compose yourself with another actor, sometimes you compose yourself with the space, sometimes you're in your own space, it's not traditional. But it called to me because he really addresses issues that are going on policy-wise, culturally-wise, in the country right now. And I'm like, that's much more interesting than, for me. I'm not saying anything against Tennessee Williams. I love him. I love Shakespeare, don't we all? But this is much more interesting, and I think it's much more needed.
So, Kevin, what drew you to socially relevant theater? Why is this what you've chosen to do?
Well, it's not the only thing I do. I mean, I write funny plays. I write.
I mean, I'm so funny. You're like, really? No. I'm funny.
No, I mean, I write. I guess what you would call straight plays that get people rolling in the aisles, and I like feature film. But I just feel as if something else is going on in our contemporary world or contemporary America, especially since the Iraq War, which is a big deal for me. I mean, I protested the war vehemently, and I just can't move on to other things or other pursuits without at least addressing that. And then, you know, the financial crisis happened, and other things are going on. And I don't think it's political or an extra effort to pursue these things. I think it's just what's going on. I mean, why wouldn't you want to explore the after effects of the Iraq War? It's like the central defining moment of our time, and this is as an American, you know.
Yeah.
Do you think your work is having an impact in terms of changing or enhancing the public discourse, which is what we're all about here? I mean, theater is a unique art form, and it reaches people on an emotional level and other levels that no other art form can. So. Yeah.
I like to think we are. I know that we've had more of an impact because some of our recent work has been seen more in Europe than here, which is a problem that I'm trying very actively to address.
Yes.
Hopefully, maybe this program might help in that effort. But I always listen to people when they come out of the theater, people who are not theater people, and I seem to think that they dig it.
Yeah. Yes.
They're getting something out of it.
Yes.
So what do you think accounts for the level of receptivity in Europe versus North America? Why are European audiences more
That's a good question.
More
That's a very good question.
Amenable.
I can answer that and get myself in trouble, so I guess I will. I think American theater and European theater has different business models or different models of funding. And when your funding comes from strictly from the state, you have more of a comfort level, more time to develop an idea, and the audience say has subsidized tickets that they can come to see as well. People are open to hearing things that they wouldn't be previously open to, like some crazy company from America coming to explode the Iraq War and the reasons why we went to war. But in America, I've noticed, and I've taken some courses in it too, we have this market-based, profit-driven system, which hasn't really changed since the days of vaudeville, in a way. This Broadway-based where everybody's investing in shares and everybody has to make a return on those shares. Mm-hmm. And I think certain ideas can only fit through that very tiny pinhole or spigot, if that makes sense.
I mean, it's very much like Hollywood in that respect.
Yeah.
It's a business and it's a business model. So Compression of a Casualty was one of your productions which got great critical acclaim, including the Santa Cruz Sentinel, which called it, and I'll quote here, a fine graphic indictment of the media's compliant approach to war. It's a stark and painful play, contemporary, frightening, and engrossing, clearly unafraid to deal with reality and present it unflinchingly. Let's take a look and a listen.
Josh Bolton and White House Communication Director Karen Hughes. I grabbed my friend Mike. How is it going over here?
It's fine,
but I can't hear the crisis conference because Mrs. Cheney keeps turning down the volume on the conference so she can hear CNN, and the Vice President keeps hanging up the open line to you. Mrs. Cheney was more than just a family member who had to be protected. She was a right-wing ideologue, and she was offering her advice and opinions in the bunker.
I think we should all just pay attention and rally around Dick. Dick will see us through. This is a result of the failure of good Christian values. Dick, this is what happens when there's no father in the home.
Just then, Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta was ushered into the bunker by the Secret Service. What's happening?
Hot stuff.
Mineta reported that an FAA was tracking a plane on a direct course to Washington.
We're watching this target on the radar. But the transponders turned off, so we have no identification.
So talk about that. What was the genesis of that play? I mean, it's clearly very powerful art.
WFD, just the low points, was started from the day that the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace released this report that the Bush administration deliberately manipulated the intelligence prior to the Iraq War. And the day that that report came out, it went nowhere. Like previous generations of like the Pentagon Papers or Watergate, the report didn't really go anywhere in the national media, the national attention span. And so we went back and we kind of examined what we were paying attention to that day, and some of those things were quite frightening. We paid attention to Trump's Apprentice, which premiered the same day, January 8th, 2004. George Bush proposed that we put a base on the moon. The Scott Peterson trial was very big at that time. So we saw what we were really paying attention to as a culture and a country, and we started to make a piece based on that tension. What were we paying attention to? What was falling through the cracks in a way?
Well, so there is a criticism that the current occupant of the White House uses distraction as an art form. In some respects, that uses Twitter in particular, but sort of some of the things that he says to distract the public from other things that are happening. Now, whether or not that's fair, you're saying that this is not a recent phenomenon.
No, it's not a recent phenomenon at all. I think it's more refined now to this level of degree, but I think the Bush administration releasing the same day the report came out that they wanted to put a man on a base on the moon is a clear ancestor of Trump's Twitter usage, if you want to say. Yeah.
Interesting.
So, speaking of the president, he has proposed in his budget to eliminate the National Endowments for the Arts and the Humanities. So, Uta, why don't we get your reaction to that first?
To say I'm disappointed is light. The NEA is not just the lifeblood for artists, but it helps develop new artists in their school programs and their programs with helping disabled veterans. There's so many areas of that are needed as the lifeblood of the culture of this country, and to just wipe it out is disheartening and depressing and very sad. Me as an artist, I already feel like I'm not very respected, let me be perfectly honest. And I have conversations with friends who have kids and kids who wanna be actors and musicians, and they don't even acknowledge that. So I always tell them about the NEA. I'm like, well, you know, the NEA does a lot of good things with kids, and you should look at that program and then compare it to what you want your kid to do and blah, 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 and it's totally cut off. But they have to understand what it's there for. It's there to motivate, is there to help young artists, is there to give to those who are unable or have the opportunity to, you know, act, write, paint, draw, anything of the sort, just to have the opportunity. And it's just, it's really horrid. It's really horrid that it seems like it's always the arts and the humanities they want to slash first. Mm.
Powerful. We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. This program can be heard four times each weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's Politics of the United States, the POTUS Channel, 124. We're produced by a world-class team here at Rhode Island PBS. I'm Jim Lutis. In my day job, I'm executive director of the Pell Center at Selvi Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island. You can tweet me at J.M. Lutis. To my right is G. Wayne Miller. He's a reporter for the Providence Journal, and you can tweet Wayne at G. Wayne Miller. We have two guests joining us this week from the sponsored by Nobody Theater Company. Kevin Doyle is a playwright who you can tweet at Sponsored Nobody. And Sauda Jackson is an actor with the Sponsored by Nobody Theater Company, and she tweets at, I'm going to spell this out, ADUAS underscore AZIZA. So, you know, so you mentioned the contrast between sort of the role of the NEA in the funding of the arts here in the United States. Europeans have a different model, a more mature model?
Well, to quote the American director, Robert Wilson, they start with a minister of culture. It's actually a position that we would say in the cabinet level here. Yeah. And so the differences start from there. But what's actually fascinating, though, is that in my research for this project, the arts, is that all of these public funding systems in all these European countries all got argued into existence for the most part in the post-World War II period, in the same time as ours did as well in America. But they're just operating on much, much higher levels of funding than the United States system is.
And there seems to be greater appetite, though, for the controversy that sometimes comes from the arts in European politics as opposed to some of the controversies that we've had in the American arts. So, Uda, I'm wondering, as an artist, as a performer, do you always agree with everything that the playwright puts in front of you?
Let me cut you off. Yeah. We don't always agree. But
how do you as an artist find that truth within to perhaps say lines that maybe are not exactly what you agree with?
You know, it's discussions with the director. You ask his opinion about the genesis of the line, the part, the scene. You tell him in comparison what you feel about it and what you feel is maybe untrue or not truly in line with what's going on in the scene. It's a lot of communication. Yeah. You have to have communication or the whole thing falls apart. Do we always agree? No, but we always get to an end result.
Could you see yourself, though, playing a role where you are making the case for the war in Iraq as opposed to a production that is perhaps critical of the war in Iraq?
I could, because it's called acting. I wouldn't agree with it. Yeah. But, you know, I went to school. I would come up with some sort of motivation and and do it. I don't agree with it, but, you know, that's what actors act.
We always like to talk craft on the show. Mm. So why don't you bring us through ATM or This Is Not New York, starting from the genesis of the idea, through the writing, through the rehearsals, through the production, and then the critical response, sort of a step-by-step.
Sure. I grew up in New York, and I was always struck by these homeless men or women would occupy the ATM sections of banks, the kind that are open 24 hours a day, and they would pretend to be doormen. Asking for admission, and on the way out, they would ask for change. And it was always no matter what was going on in New York, there was always a constant. And so because it was a constant, I thought it was a good way in to talk about the financial crisis and the stresses of living and making work in New York. And so that was the genesis, and I just had the idea that we're going to set it inside that ATM, an ATM section of a bank, and that the actors would be coming in and out for these four cycles or four turns. And I think it was like through each turn, there was a different focus.
We each had a different focus every time we came through a turn.
Like one time a focus would be financial worries, another would be trying to think some other ones.
Did you write a script and keep to it strictly, or?
Well, that one was born out of interviews. That was born out of interviews with New York City residents. It was born out of interviews with homeless people at, we were in residence at this place called the University Settlements on the Lower East Side. It was also interviews with actors in the ensemble, getting their thoughts about what it was like living in New York.
That's right.
Yes.
That showed you and, my
check. So you did the interview?
I did all the interviews with everybody, yeah. And then we did transcripts, and then I would kind of print out all the interviews and kind of whittle down these anchor points or these catchy phrases or moments or the really meat and bones, and that would become the script. That would become these rotating cycles and turns.
So you put a lot of research, a lot of work into the scripts that you produce.
Yes.
Where does that come from, and why is that important to the work that you're doing?
I don't know. I think we perfected this process on the WMD project, where we were all responsible for investigating what happened that day on January 8th, 2004. Actors, designers, everybody, and the results that came out of it is that it's like a filtration process. You get these really great nuggets or kernels of truth that come out of this filtration process, but you have to cast a wide net first, mm-hmm. And the wider net you cast, the more you get down to this distilled level. Whether it's in terms of video design, or whether it's in terms of audio design, or whether it's in terms of spoken dialogue. And it's kind of become our modus operandi for the last few projects, including the one we're working on now.
It reminds me of investigative reporting, and we've had a number of investigative reporters and folks on this show, but the methodology sounds very similar. Do you have any training in journalism or training in detective work? Or
no.
In this day and age, everybody just really... I mean, luckily with the internet, I'm old enough to remember before the internet. with the internet, you can find anything, and it really adds to performances in my case.
Yeah.
To be able to.
One of the things that distinguishes the theater that you do is the use of multimedia and the use of other media on stage. It's not just actors and costumes reciting lines.
Yeah.
So I want to ask both about from the production value, but I also want to hear from the actor working with multimedia. What's that experience like as compared to sort of straight theater?
It's actually, I think your show was the first show that I ever did multimedia with. And,
yeah.
And I was very awkward at first because there's a camera in my face, and we're doing these turns, and we're walking into walls, and we're not speaking to one another. And I'm like, I was really confused for the first week, and then I let it absorb, and I thought about it, and then it was freeing when I really let go and just sort of did it. It was very incredible because it just wasn't the regular way.
It's an element of the storytelling, though. It's right.
In
some respects, it seems sort of important to the kinds of stories you're telling in the media environment that are operating today. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's very fair. Yeah, I think it's very accurate. I think I was just in Bangladesh for 3 months, for example, and these women that I met who survived this factory fire had been interviewed by so many reporters, so many documentarians, but nothing had changed for them. And I think we in the West, Western countries, we have this kind of built-in resistance now to hard-nosed journalism reporting or gritty documentaries, and we just kind of ignore it. And I think working this way, this multimedia way, interdisciplinary way, on stage, with pre-recorded film, live camera, kind of subverts that resistance a little bit. It finds some way in to the audience who normally would just be like, "Oh, I don't want to see this story or whatever."
Yeah. And
so you were 3 months in Bangladesh. What were you doing?
I was there on a grant from the Asian Cultural Council in New York to research the garment industry and also specifically the women who survived the 2012 Tazreen factory fire.
Oh yeah,
which was identical to the almost identical to the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire that happened in New York City.
The garment district.
Yes,
correct.
And literally the same conditions, almost the same casualty figures. The women in both situations were told to stay at their desks, keep on working. And I found it just interesting to explore how the same conditions can be replicated and reproduced 100 years apart and like 8,000 miles away.
Yeah.
It was fascinating.
Well, in some respects, this is sort of the dark underbelly of globalization, because in a lot of ways, the manufacturers have chased cheap labor and poor labor standards. And so you can reproduce literally a century apart these incredible tragedies because it's easier to make a buck if you're paying people dirt wages and not worrying about labor conditions.
Yeah. So what is going to come out of your Bangladesh experience? A play, I'm assuming?
I'm hoping there's going to be a large-scale multimedia interdisciplinary theater piece. The women who survived the fire, I met with a total of 8 of them. They want to collaborate long-term.
Really? So they would be part of this?
Yeah, I'm actually working on some applications right now to get them to come over here and actually work with members of the company and also I would like to have them meet some workers from Walmart, because Walmart, they were making Walmart clothing when the fire happened. Oh. And Walmart, to this date, has refused to offer any compensation to them at all.
Wow, that would be very powerful.
Yeah.
So how, I think you're quite right. There's a flood almost of investigative reporting, and no knock on it, because it's all very important.
Yeah, I didn't mean to
document.
Yeah.
No, I know you weren't.
Yeah.
Documentary filmmaking, but theater, particularly the way you practice it, connects in a different way. Talk about that. I mean, this is...
Yeah,
you're breaking through sort of the clatter, as it were.
We're trying to break through, and I think something to also say is that we use humor also. I mean, some of the stuff, we walk a fine line between whether some of this stuff is very funny.
Not all death and tragedy.
Yeah, no,
yeah.
It's not all.
It's actually, some of it is quite hilarious. I like setting people up a little bit during the course of performance that there's bizarre, funny things happening, because it is bizarre and funny, some of these situations, but usually get them settled first and then come in for a punch later.
So the one question that I have is, you've spoken, and we've got about a minute and a half left here,
okay,
but one of the things that you have come back to a couple times was the impact that the Iraq War had on you as sort of an impetus towards this socially relevant storytelling. What so offended you in the national experience there?
Well, the fact that there was no weapons of mass destruction. The Swedish ambassador, who's the UN guy, I forget his name, the inspector, he clearly came back and said there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. Hans Blix. I just think us as a country, we have not really come to terms with the results of our actions. I've met many Iraqi refugees living in Sweden and Finland and Belgium and the Netherlands, and they're still wondering what the hell happened to their lives, let alone the service members who were.
Are they familiar with the work that you've done?
We've worked directly with some of the refugees I mentioned. Yes, they were actually in the WMD piece also, and it meant a lot for them to be talking to Americans, because previously they only saw them on the tops of tanks.
We've got to leave it here, unfortunately. It's tremendous work you're doing,
Thank you.
We're going to get down to New York and come to a production.
Kevin
Doyle and Sauda Jackson, for more information about their work with the Sponsored by Nobody Theater Company, visit them at sponsoredbynobody.com. If you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, follow us on Twitter and Facebook, or visit pellcenter.org. I'm Jim Lutis. He's G. Wayne Miller. We hope you'll see you next week for another edition of Story in the Public Square.